And now, it's time to sit back and enjoy the Two True Freaks Internet Radio Broadcast.
The Vault of Startling Monster Horror Tales of Terror!
Hello, kiddies. It's your old pal, the Chris Keeper, here again. Well, there's been a little change up here at the Horror Vault. It seems our financier, Demanza Corp of Milan, Italy, they feel that we're concentrating too much on the American horror. And we've got a memo here from the boss himself, Dufo Damanzo, demanding more Italian horror. So, for the next few months, we will be taking you on a tour of Italy, one bloody cinema masterpiece at a time. Otherwise, it's back to bussing tables for the old Chris Keeper.
Ciao, li miei amici. Benvenuto a Two True Freaks. I am Luke Giaconetti, and this is the Vault of Startling Monster Horror Tales of Terror. And as always, my co-hosts on the show, first off, the indomitable Chris Honeywell.
Hey, Minga!
And we now have the incomparable hair metal hero.
Manja.
And joining us officially, although he was on our special episode on the Alien Quadrilogy, which just aired, is the indefatigable Sean Engel.
Buongiorno.
Oh, we're so ethnic. And,
as you may have guessed from the Pigged in Italian that has opened up the show, we are going to be starting our series on Italian horror. And we are going to be starting right at the beginning of Italian horror by looking at some of the films of Mario Bava. And Mario Bava, for those that don't know, is generally credited as the father of Italian horror. But believe it or not, his influence on Italian cinema spreads much, much farther than that. Bava was the son of Eugenio Bava, who was a pioneer special effects man in Italy and became a very well-known cameraman during the silent period of Italian cinema. Bava wanted to become an artist, but when that didn't pan out, ended up moving into the film industry like his dad. He became a cinematographer right in the end of 1939, right before World War II, and then picked up again after that. He was known for doing cinematography in all sorts of different genres, including westerns, historical romances, gladiator pictures, and eventually did work on what is known as the first Italian horror film, a film called I Vampiri, which was directed by Riccardo Freda. Now, Freda walked off the film partway through, and Bava finished it up uncredited. He would repeat this a couple of times, including the film that actually was released in the States called Kaltiki, the Immortal Monster, which was a blob ripoff, and a film called The Day the Sky Exploded, which he technically co-directed but was credited solely to his collaborator, Paolo Hesch. The studio that Bava did these films for was so impressed with his ability to finish up other people's films on time and under budget that they gave him his own project, which could be whatever he wanted, which brings us to our film tonight, 1960's Black Sunday. And this is a gothic horror film. Black Sunday was a throwback to the works of folks such as James Whale and the other Universal monster directors of the 30s and 40s.
But, oh, yeah.
But definitely brought Bava's cinematic flair to the proceedings.
Yeah, definitely you can tell that Bava was had a lot of cinematography, or he had a lot of cinematography work before he came into the directing thing. In fact, isn't he credited in the film at being the primary photographer for the film?
Yes, it's believe it or not, that's less common here in the States, but in Europe it was not uncommon, especially during this period, for the director to also do his own cinematography.
Makes sense, and you can tell that he's got a handle on it. There's some really interesting shots that I noticed in the film, specifically one where he does the trope of the 360 camera rotation where he starts on the people and rotates the camera all around the room and then comes back to the people while they're narrating something. It's really it's a common shot nowadays, but seeing it in a film from the 1960s, it was kind of interesting that it was there at the time.
Mm-hmm.
It was very interesting because it was a 60s film that looked like a 40s film with some ahead of its time camera moves, you know, a couple zooms here and there.
Yeah.
Lots of moving cameras, lots of dollies and crane shots, and very nice, you know, not just like handheld moving camera, very nicely plotted out. The scene where the wind comes through the house, it happens a couple times actually, but especially the first time when the, you know, it starts at the fireplace flaring up and the wind just moves through the house. That's a fantastic shot.
Yeah, that and the similar to the one Sean referred to when we see the reveal of the prince when we're in his room and we see the crucifix on the floor, and then it does the 180 degree rotation really quick to show his corpse. I've always really liked that shot again because it looks like it's, you know, just so super quick, but it's very smooth. It's not jerky. It's clearly not done with handheld. And it just, you know, I just love that kind of mobility of the frame. I always have.
Well, Luke, do you, since probably most of the people who are listening to this are also kind of like the three of us, not that familiar with this film, do you want to go give a quick synopsis so people can get an idea of what they're getting into?
Okay, well, Black Friday is very, very loosely based on a Russian short story called Vi. And Vi is a story deals more with a witch who is put to death and then helps resurrect, or basically it's brings Satan back to life for the one day a year that he's one day a century he's allowed to come back to life. Black Friday, which in its native Italian is La Maschera del Demonio, which is the mask of the devil, is a little more straightforward. Basically, a beautiful witch named Azza. She is put to death in the 17th century by her brother. She's actually branded with the mark of Satan, and then a satanic mask is hammered into her face. And she and her lover, Giavuto, are both cast out as witches and buried in unconsecrated ground. A couple of centuries later, in this very area, the descendants of this witch still live, including her great-great-great-great-great-whatever, granddaughter, who looks just like her, and is, of course, played by Barbara Steele. And two doctors, Kravujin and Gorobek, who are traveling through this tiny little village, end up getting mixed up in all sorts of badness when they accidentally resurrect Azza, and she then brings back Giavuto, and so all sorts of badness is spilled on this family because Azza still wants revenge on this family for putting her to death as a witch two centuries earlier. So it's definitely as a lot, you know, this, it's, you know, we tend to think about the prosecution of witches and witchcraft, especially being burned. We tend to think of that a lot of in, I think, American terms because of the Salem witch trials.
Right.
You know, so, and that's something we all learn as history. But, you know, the way that witches were dealt with all throughout that time period, it's all over the world. You know, every country has their own stories about prosecuting and persecuting those who were believed to be Satan worshippers or, you know, practicing witchcraft or black magic or juju, or, you know, depending on where you were in the world, it was called something different. But the tropes kind of fit, and they're put to real good use here because this is an Italian film that actually takes place in Russia. And so it kind of plays on both the European and more the Eastern European ideas of witchcraft and Satanism.
Yeah, well, they did still have the trope of having the witch burned, but they did something different in this one, which was, of course, putting the mask on her. And I guess that was one of the things that got this film sort of notoriety, especially for 1960 when it was filmed, because of the fact that they actually put this mask with spikes on it, and then not only on Azza's face, but then after that, they have one of the people in the black mask come with a giant sledgehammer and smash it into her head.
Yeah.
Essentially driving the stakes in the mask into her face. It's a really disturbing image, especially
pretty gruesome, yeah.
Time.
Well, it's all the lead up to it too, where they show them carrying the mask and you can see her through the eye hole in it. It's particularly effective.
Yeah, actually, it's funny because two of the scenes that were cut when the Mask of Satan was brought over to the States as Black Friday both happen in the first 2 minutes. And that's Aja being branded, where, you know, we actually see the brand burning her flesh. Mm-hmm. And then the mask being hammered on her face. And the first note I made is, you know, 2 minutes into the movie, a woman gets branded with a hot iron and a mask with spikes hammered onto her face. It's like in 1960, this was so beyond the pale from what people were used to from especially black and white horror films.
Right. Something that looked like it was from James Whale era of like, movies. Yeah,
exactly. And it was the sign that, okay, this is something else right here. You know?
Yeah, but it still does sort of harken back, like you said, to the James Whale, Universal horror monsters of that time. It has that, but it just the Italian ideal, I guess, sort of, you know, brings it to a new level.
Yeah, well, Bava, and actually we'll see this as a recurring theme, is that, and because here's the thing, all the guys we're going to look at, they all in the end come back to Bava. They either were directly influenced by him, were contemporaries with him, worked under him, things like that. And once the trope that Bava would come back to over and over in his films, no matter the genre, because as I said, Bava is known for working in horror, but he also did science fiction. He did peplum. He did peplum being a sword and sandal films. He directed what's generally regarded as the best sword and sandal film of all time, which is Hercules and the Haunted World. And so he did all these different types of genre films, and hell, he also did Dr. Goldfoot and the Girl Bombs, if you guys remember.
Oh, jeez.
And you Mystery Science Theater 3000 fans, Danger Diabolic was also his. But the concept of what we've referred to here as the unblinking eye, to if something is important to the story and it's something that's horrible, to show it to you and not to just imply it, because I think it goes back to his background as a sculptor and an artist. I think the idea of showing you something rather than implying it is speaks to his artistic mentality. And, you know, that, of course, would eventually become the, you know, kind of cliches of Italian horror of just, you know, splatter and gruesome acts all over the screen. But and this looks relatively tame next to that. But again, considering the time, you know, this was shocking material, and that was the point. It was meant to shock. It was meant to show the cruelty of what the inquisitors did to Aja. And so that, you know, yes, she is definitely the villain. You know, she's a witch that's getting her revenge on a family that really the family members she's taking it out on really haven't done anything. But at the same time, it's showing the cruelty of both sides.
Well, that's the thing I'm used to these days. Whenever they address like the Salem witch trials or something, it's always from a sympathetic point of view to the witch, because it's usually like, well, you know, these were women that were getting persecuted for other reasons or because of ignorance or whatever. But in this case, you know, you find out she probably had it coming to her, you know?
She was a witch, so.
Yeah, she was a witch, and she was actively, I don't know if she was actively evil. Maybe she only went actively evil when they were about to hammer a, you know, a mask onto her face, which is a good motivation for turning evil. So, but I, just by the way, well, no, she must have probably been a vampire before that too.
Yeah.
So, and that's another weird thing about it is there's elements of witch and vampire to her. And I was wondering, I was like, is this movie, because they kept saying she's a vampire. But I was wondering if the movie was ever going to address it in a, you know, in an actual with blood sucking and stuff, which it actually did.
Yeah.
To an extent, you know, that they were blood suckers, and I like that it's a stake to the eye.
Yes. and actually, Aza and Javuto in the when it, as it was being shot had fangs that they wore, but they apparently looked so bad that they stopped using them, and Bava cut around them for what they had already shot.
Well, Barbara Steele has kind of weird, like, sharp teeth anyway. She has kind of strange teeth to begin with, so she's sort of perfect for that.
She's got strange features in general, man.
Yes, she's is a perfect scream queen face, you know, angular cheekbones and that sort of vampira look to her, you know?
It's so, like and, if yeah, if it's Morticia Adams was real.
Right, and she can play the evil vampire, and she can play the, you know, the virgin princess, you know, who's, you know, frightened and scared for her life, and have them both work.
I don't know if you guys noticed, I watched the Anchor Bay DVD, which is part of the Bava Collection box, which if you got, it's out of print, but if you can find this box set, I think it's called the Mario Bava Collection from Anchor Bay, buy it because it's fantastic. That on the, and it, what it is, it uses the American optics, but it has the Italian soundtrack on it, and it's uncut. She's actually credited as Barbara Steele, S-T-E-E-L. Mm-hmm. They dropped the last E, apparently, off her name, which I thought was kind of funny. It's like Barbara Steele. That sounds like a 70s female cop movie, you know?
Maybe Bava was just, you know, harkening back to the Hercules Unchained type stuff that he worked with and just changed their name that way.
Bill Steve Reeves. And what's funny is that Steele was real young when she made this film, and I think she was like 19. And there was a lot of problems on the set with her because she didn't speak Italian, so she couldn't speak to the crew. They had to go through interpreters. She had a problem with drinking at this time also.
Oh.
And so there's a story that one day she refused to come to the set because someone told her that the special film the Italians used would let them film her naked.
Interesting.
And so, you know, Bava had to deal with...
If anybody was going to invent that film, you know it would be the Italians, though.
Oh, yeah.
And you know it would be done in DiMonzacorp Labs, too.
So Steele herself has acknowledged that she was impossible to work with and that she was basically just a young diva and didn't know any better. But it always is fun for me when a film has a, you know, a contentious background at some point and it doesn't show up on screen. I always like that. And it certainly doesn't. Her performance is equal parts, you know, creepy and seductive, which is really suits her character.
Oh, I agree. You know, she definitely personified the sort of evil vampire queen, and you know, she was menacing and also sensual at the same time. It was a really good performance from her.
Right. Yeah.
As opposed to whoever did the dub job for Andre.
Oh.
Oh my God. He sounds like a parody of, you know, like, you know, Brad, good guy. You know?
Yeah, I had trouble listening to the dubbing in this. Not gonna lie.
Yes,
It was just him. Everybody else was fine, but he just had this like, well,
I don't know. I thought that was an issue with me throughout the whole thing. I'm like, I can tell it's dubbed, and they didn't do a good job.
It's, you know, it's something you got to deal with sometimes.
Yeah.
On foreign films. You know, they do a good job, and unfortunately, a lot of times with European films, they do not.
Well, if there was one thing that kind of made this film negative, it was the dub job. I don't know if there are or if the in the Bava box set that they have subs as well.
I don't believe they do. I think I'm not on this one. I think some of the others may, but I don't think Black Friday had a new subtitle track on it. I think that it has the closed caption which I guess could work, but I don't know if it has the Italian language, so you'd have to mute it, and that doesn't help.
Yeah.
The Anchor Bay discs were always odd. Sometimes they would put the Italian language track in, which is great, but then not put English subtitles in it.
Really?
You know, it's a Region 1 disc, guys. Most of us speak English.
Right.
just say it.
Well, that's the big debate with all foreign movies. You know, I know Hope has probably talked about this on her show, that a lot of times when you get films or the dubbing, the American dubbing is very slipshod or haphazard, and it's not really, it doesn't really go with the film. And here, like I have to agree with you guys, the Doctor, he wasn't dubbed well.
No.
Well, the thing about it is, I don't mind, like, if it's all the way through the movie, they're going to be dubbed and a little bit off all the way through the movie, and everybody's going to be like that, no problem. It's just like in a regular English movie where they foleyed in somebody's dialogue because they flubbed it on the set or whatever, and it's glaringly obvious, you know. That'll bring me right out of it. But with this one, everybody was dubbed in, and everybody was about, you know, uniformly off kilter with the lips. But it was just Andre's voice was so, you know, you might remember me from such films as Black Sunday.
The funny thing is that originally, now the film was recorded. Everybody actually spoke English except for the actor who played Dr. Kruvajan. And who was the other one? I had it here and now I don't have it. Oh, and Javuto. Everyone else, they played their roles in Italian, but everyone else actually played in English. If you look at the cast, there's a decent number of Americans on here. Mm-hmm. And so when AIP had bought the rights to show the film, they wanted a dub version. Well, there's a there was a firm in Italy that did the dubbing on the last two. Well, AIP, actually Samuel Z. Arkoff himself, said no. He hated that and commissioned an entirely new dub for everybody, which is why everybody is dubbed now, and that's why we actually don't hear Barbara Steele's voice in any version of the film. So, which I just thought that was odd, you know. But and it always is a thing with dubbing, and especially it seems to be with Italian films, because with Asian films, and this is something I talk about on Earth Destruction Directive, is that after a while, Toho especially started just making their own what they'd call international versions, where they would ship the films to Hong Kong typically, and then they would have them dubbed by a professional English speaking cast, and then those were the versions they would offer for international distribution. European films never seem to they always seem to be more I don't want to say slipshod, but it was more of a roll of the dice what kind of release you were going to get, how much your film was going to be cut up and rearranged.
Hey, come on, man, we work for DiMonzo, you can say it. Cheap.
Yeah, you know, it is. It is cheap, but at the same time, it's also the type of genre films they were making lent themselves to being distributed by, you know, cheap American distributors.
Right.
Looking, fuck. You know, I mean, I'll never forget a film by Lucio Fulci called The House by the Cemetery. When it was distributed in the U.S., the distributor put two of the reels out of order. So the film jumps ahead 20 minutes and jumps backwards. You can't fake that level of incompetence, you know?
No, you can't.
So to me, even with the not good dubbing, just watching the film in the order that it was intended to be in, that's excuse. And the thing also, I have got to say, I've talked about this before, but man, when you get a really well restored black and white movie on DVD, does it look beautiful or what?
Yeah, I actually watched mine. I've got a Blu-ray player, and I had it. It's an upscaling DVD player, and I watched this film, and man, black and white films really have a lot of contrast. They have a lot of depth to them, and it's really
different.
Nice to watch a good
They're
one.
Different
yeah.
than color. They're physical. Yeah. Black and white film in a print, especially a nice off the master print and nicely. You see, the thing about dubbing, it's a true art getting film onto a DVD, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. Because there is a dimension to the grain of that of those silver particles in the film, and it's just like you know, the famous photographers, that they have people, you know, who specialize in making prints of their you know, really famous photographs, because they're talented at bringing out the dimensionality of that black and white, and that's why it's a shame that, like, people don't really understand why black and white was so awesome. It's sort of appreciated now in a retro sort of way, and some people do a film in black and white to sort of say, oh, this is harkens back to the past or something, but taking your high-def video or taking your movie that you made and then bleeding the color out of it, not the same as lighting it and using the right film stock. And this movie, you can tell there was lots of cinematographer experience going on because it was beautifully lit. The use of, you know, foreground, middle ground, and background was, you know, almost constantly in play. There was you're almost always looking through like the space between two candelabras or two very scary looking, you know, wolf sculptures in the foreground with cobwebs on them, and just gorgeous.
Yeah, and it's films like Black Sunday that, you know, a lot of times genre directors get kind of a, you know, that condescending praise. Mm-hmm. It's like, he's really good for a horror director, you know, mm-hmm. that kind of stuff. And that is always, that, you know, any genre director gets that, and that has always pissed me off. Bava, in the way that he shoots his films, this is why he's one of the very few, especially European genre directors, who will get, you know, unqualified praise from critics, from viewers, because, you know, everything he shoots, it's just magical to look at after a while.
Yeah.
And even if the film is not so great, one of the early films he finished up for someone else was a peplum called Giants of Marathon, actually starred a pre-Hercules Steve Reeves in it. Ooh. And it's not a good film. Not a good film. It doesn't make a lot of sense. There's long scenes of Greek men in diapers fighting with Persians wearing funny hats. 30 minutes out of clip of this, you know, not a good film. But even a lousy, cheap peplum, he makes it look good. And so it's kind of frustrating because words are being said that you're just like, why am I watching this? But it's like, ooh, but that's pretty.
Turn off your brain and turn on your eyes for that one, I guess.
And the scene that I love in this, that as far as just the total combination of the lighting, the cinematography, and then the special effects, is when Javuto rises from his grave. That whole sequence after Aja is revived, and I do want to say her being revived by the blood, very common in British vampire cinema. That was a trick Hammer would use over and over.
Yeah, somebody dripping a little drip on Dracula's lips.
Yeah, actually, a great scene of that in Dracula, Prince of Darkness, where his servant, you know, hangs the guy above the coffin and slits his throat. But here it's a little more subtle.
Well, I want to ask about that, Luke. Is that, would Bava be one of the premieres of doing that? Is this one of the things that Bava originated, or is this something that Hammer may have come up with? You know, the whole, I accidentally cut, you know, I have a cut in there and had a drop of blood drop onto this coffin. I accidentally knocked the cross that's supposed to be keeping her here. I'm sorry I broke it. I hope that doesn't do anything.
I'm thinking the hand of fate was coming in at that point and guiding all his hilarious mishaps.
And as far as the blood dripping on there, Prince of Darkness, I want to say, was made the same year as this or very close to it. I'm not 100%, I don't remember exactly. But in both cases, and Bava was a big fan of legend and myth, and that's why he chose to shoot Vi. Actually, I'm way off. Prince of Darkness was 1966. I don't know what I'm saying. But that I have heard of that trope being used in vampire lore about the blood. Mm-hmm. Although it's often the blood of a virgin.
Virgin.
That had to be poured on their ashes. Mm. And something like that. So I'm sure it was just something that, you know, Bava had read and wanted to use. You know, this film borrows so liberally from so many different horror legends from all across Europe. I would love to know where that came from. I'm not a vampire expert by any stretch. I know that they're not supposed to sparkle and they're supposed to act more like they do in this movie where they kill people. That's just me.
Well, but it did take on a lot of the tropes and a lot of the ideas, like I said, of the Universal horror films. It definitely had callbacks to Dracula with the cross. And the other thing that I really liked about this film, and it's probably because it is an Italian film, is that they didn't shy away from the religious aspects of it.
Yes.
All the people, you know, firmly believed that the crucifix or the cross could ward away evil. There was obvious, in the end, the person who came to destroy Aja was the priest and the people from the town. Yeah. There were numerous references to, essentially the power of Christ compelling you. So it was, for me, that was kind of neat that they actually didn't shy away from.
Oh, it was Christ and that, Satan.
It was the quote unquote the big battle. You know, it was.
Well, nowadays, how many times have you seen since Salem's Lot? You know, the vampire just grab onto the cross and either say like, "That's an old wives' tale," or "You got to believe," or whatever. You know, it's just. Well,
and you know, but the thing is mentioning Salem's Lot. Of course, that's I think the first thing anyone our age would think of. And it, with what Sean was talking about, with the inherent faith in the crucifix, and I think it speaks actually to the same idea. In Salem's Lot, the whole point of it is that he thinks that just a symbol will save him from
right.
The, he doesn't have the faith, whereas everyone here has faith.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
That holding that crucifix does drive off. Like when Cravusian comes in and he's possessed, he gets repulsed by it. Because the prince has faith in the crucifix. So it's not just a talisman. It actually is a symbol of the power that is diametrically opposed to their own. Mm-hmm. And I think you're right. I think you hit the nail right in the head, Sean. This being a Italian film made by a bevy of mustachioed Roman Catholics, the aspect of faith and Christianity versus the satanic. And remember also that, I don't mean to get on a religious topic here, but especially in Roman Catholicism, Satan is not a concept. You know, Satan is an actual fallen angel who is out to get your soul. You know, Satan is not, oh, there's bad things in the world. You know, Satan is a physical being. So, you know, that again, that is this, so it's informed by that kind of thought process. You know,
well, this is why it makes Bava a perfect fit for filming a movie of this genre, of this type, because he obviously has the ideals and background that would, you know, affirm his belief of, you know, Satan being an actual entity rather than just being a concept of evil. So yeah. It works well for this.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's that that brew of Italian, like, religion and then the guilt associated with religion and the over-the-topness of it, plus the just, like, mood is everything, at least in, like, the Italian movies I've seen, like, almost the runs from the goriest zombie film to the, you know, to the artiest, you know, horror film. They've all just had, you know, a pervasive mood.
Yeah.
And there's sort of an under mood that's like the Italian mood that's just a little weird. And then each movie has its own individual, you know, mood off of that. But, you know, that's story and everything. The story can be either very simple and not make a lot of sense or very complicated and make a lot of sense. But it never seems to matter because it usually is transporting you into a weird sort of altered reality almost.
I'm getting the feeling that this stretch of the show is we're going to be, the phrase grand guignol is going to come up quite a bit, and that's just off of seeing this one film. Yeah. So.
This tamer one of the film, you know, they're going to get more.
They're going to
You know what, when you see a metal spiked mask getting driven into a chick's face, that's, you know.
There's an old saying that if you see boobs in the first 2 minutes of a film, you know your film's going to suck. What does it say when you see a woman being branded and with an Iron Maiden mask pounded into her face in the first 2 minutes? What does that tell you about what you're going to watch?
Well, if it's talking about this film, it's going to be awesome. Because this, you know, like I said, this is just another one of those films that I had no idea of about. And I've watched a lot of horror films. And it takes the elements of classic horror and puts that Italian spin on it and puts the sort of gore into it, but not gore in the aspect that you would see in a lot of American films, and it melds it all together really well. It's really an impressive film, and for not really a debut, but one of the movies that sort of sparked his career, it's a great start for Bava.
Yeah, and this film was a success on both sides of the Atlantic. This was actually AIP, like I said, released this as Black Friday, I think in 1961, and it became a pretty big hit. And then you look at the, and even that, and even then in its trimmed down form where they took out some of the more gruesome aspects, it was still seen as kind of the knee plus ultra of gore at the time. And but then you look at the influence that it's had on other filmmakers. You know, Tim Burton has said that Sleepy Hollow is basically his homage to Black Friday. Or excuse me, Black Sunday. I'm saying Black Friday. Black Friday is a different movie. And that is basically his homage to Black Sunday, to the point that there's even a character whose face is punctured by an Iron Maiden in that film.
Wow, and, I didn't know that. I always got a Hammer vibe from that one, but
it's a mix of Hammer and Black Sunday in there. But
I think it's probably Christopher Lee and Sleepy Hollow that definitely gives it that Hammer feel.
Yeah, but it's, you know, it's all these films kind of bred into each other also during the 60s. It was, you know, a lot of this dealt with that there was, you know, we where we grew up, we're used to seeing the old Universal films on TV. You know, I remember watching on Channel 11 PIX, they would show.
Yep, me too.
Wars. But, you know, it wasn't until after World War II that Universal created what was called the Shock syndication package, and then Son of Shock was the second one, where they syndicated a lot of their old horror films for television distribution. And so growing up, if you were growing up in the 50s, you would see Frankenstein, The Wolfman, Dracula, Bride of Frankenstein. You would see a lot of these, the horror films, and the old Dark House type movies, along with some of the other lesser known ones, some stuff like Murders in the Rue Morgue or Murders in the Zoo, which is a great old horror film. They would see these on TV. This introduced it to a whole new generation of viewers. And that is what led to the revival of the gothic horrors, both in from studios like Hammer and Amicus in the United Kingdom. This would lead to the gothic creamy films, as they're called, in Germany, and would lead to stuff like this out of the Italian cinema, you know. So it's I think a lot of people were kind of growing up being reintroduced to this stuff and looking at it with a new appreciation, because while the Universal films were very popular, they were kind of looked down upon by critics at the time, for the most part, not all of them, but a lot of them were seen as just kind of, you know, penny dreadfuls or, you know, just, you know, opiate for the masses type of crap cinema, which, you know, now we recognize the quality behind them, but at the time they were just seen as geek show. And I think that you're right. It was kind of a combination of new technology, new ideas in how to film these stories, and an appreciation for the basic ideas of these tales that led to this kind of rebirth of goth in the late 50s, early 60s that gave us films like this.
Oh, I agree. I just love how he can work with his limitations to his advantage. You know, basically this was all shot on sets. I don't think there was anything like actually shot outdoors, probably.
When they were found the body by the river, that's probably it.
Right, right. And right, dude, that's right.
I love that when we're, you know, just the kids playing. And I love that, first off, the older sister says, "Don't knock over this basket." And what do?
Yeah, exactly.
If you any of you have kids, listen to that, and you know exactly how she feels. But then, yeah, you know, the rest of the film is all kind of murky and dark, because it takes place in tombs or at night. And there's this sun-drenched shot, and we find the body next to the river. You know, just it's the contrast between the innocence of the kids playing and the doctor, you know, innocently asking for directions, and then we find the corpse. You know, I like that a lot. I'm gushing. I'm sorry.
Yeah, no, it's a nice little multitasking scene. You know, it's getting the you know, the doctor from one place to another, and it also, you know, it moves along with him because he comes running in. You know, the camera's already sort of tracking from left to right, and he comes running in and asks directions and keeps going and sort of goes up the hill, which pulls the camera along with him, which pulls it to the body. There's just was a lot of thought put into almost everything about this movie.
And I do also want to talk a little bit about the special effects. because mm-hmm. Bob was a bit of a pioneer in doing special effects, and all his stuff obviously was all in the frame kind of stuff. And one of the ones I'd mentioned before about Javuto's rising from the grave, when the tomb explodes, it's so basic. It's just that there's a couple of stagehands rocking that thing underneath it, and then they see the explosion. But man, I think that's really well done. You know, you don't. It's not the kind of standard thing of the crypt opening slowly with a really creaky hinge on it or something like that. I mean, Aja's not screwing around. She's coming back and she's mad.
Yeah, and there's this power emanating off of her.
And then, of course, the bit at the very end where he pulls on her robe and it's bone. Oh, man. That's classic. And
where the reveal is basically her chest cavity and it's all just bone and no skin and tissue that she hasn't completely reformed from her death.
Yeah.
That was creepy as hell.
Yeah. And, you know, at that point, we've already gotten the spike through the eye and the stake through the eye and some of that. So it's we know that it's not her, but, you know, he doesn't. So we've got depth of knowledge on the hero. And so to reveal it in such a, it's only a second. It's not like they linger on it. Like what all, you know, a lot of Italian horror directors like to. It's like, we spent money for this effect. God damn it, we are going to show it, kind of thing.
We're going to get it from every angle, yeah.
Here, it's just a flash of it, and we, you know, it's so visceral that it as an image, I think it sticks with you. And a somewhat similar scene in a later film called Inferno, which is directed by Dario Argento. There's a scene. Now, Bava actually did the special effects. He was mostly retired by that point, but he came in and helped out the effects on that film, one of Argento's few supernatural films. And there's a scene in there where we see a woman walking. Basically, she's on one side of a mirror walking towards the camera, and our protagonist is on the other side of the mirror. And it's all done in the frame where she reaches out and touches the mirror from the backside and it shatters. And then she is there, but her face is now a skull. And so that, every time I see Inferno, I think about the scene here in Black Sunday, which is, you know, kind of the same type of effect with the juxtaposition of healthy flesh and then bone, you know, which to me is it's not as stomach churning as, you know, mangled flesh or something, but it's to me it's creepier because
this is a more of a creepy movie, you know, anything.
I mean, bone, there's no way that can be alive, you know. I think it gets back to my love of the skeleton dance from when I was a little kid, you know, Ubi works, you know.
Mm-hmm. Well, I love the effect of when her eyes are kind of growing back.
Yes.
Of her skull. It's kind of vague as to what's going on, and it almost has a feel of sort of the reverse of the end of Raiders of the Lost Ark. You know, it almost looks like they filmed something melting in reverse, but it wasn't. It was some live effect, and that was really eerie. It was like you could almost, just by watching it, you could almost see the doctor's thought process, which would be like, something's happening there. But, you know, you would think as soon as, like, their eyes started to grow back, you might want to run away or freak out or something. But he was probably sitting there going, what the hell's going? You know, his mind probably wasn't really processing it, you know, as something that could actually happen. And I thought that was really neat and kind of subtle effect.
I don't know. Personally, if I see someone who's in a tomb or in a coffin and suddenly parts of their body start growing back, my first thought is, you know, burn it with fire. But maybe that's just me.
That's your first mistake, is being there in the first place.
Yeah. I was going to say, if we did that, you would turn, tell me to run, you'd be talking to yourself. So I got to say.
Well, this is what I got. This is what I, my question in this is, the first time they got a hold of her and took care of her by burning her. That did not work out. So at the end of that, what do they do to her? They do the exact same thing. They throw her on the fire. I'm like, all right, why doesn't she just curse them again? You know, I mean, all she has to do is say, hey, Satan, guess what? It's time to
Well, if you remember, it was because the storm came and put the fires out. And so that so that she was not dead yet when she made the curse. Whereas here, it was a clear night, I'm presuming.
We hope.
You know, actually...
She's probably a bit drier this time. She probably went up a bit faster.
Yeah, she's a tiny cure. It's funny that the character of Asta is a somewhat minorly popular character in the realms of vampire crossover fiction. And I don't mean like fan fiction. I mean like, you know, fan fiction that gets published sort of thing.
Right, right.
You know, I was reading on Wikipedia that there's one series where the main plot of a story is an arranged marriage between Aja and Count Dracula.
Ooh, sexy.
Which in my mind is, you know, Barbara Steele hooking up with Christopher Lee, personally. Just, you know, so it's she does kind of fit. I think, Sean, I think you made this point earlier about her being kind of the Barbara Steele being kind of perfectly play the vampire princess. And the character of Aja is a real good example of that. I like the when she calls to Kravusian from across the tomb, and you know you can see that he's trying to fight it, but he's not trying really hard. That he wants to give in and be seduced by her.
Well, who wouldn't? I mean, aside from the big holes in her face, you know, that's I'd hit that.
Hey, man, those are just opportunities.
Oh, there's the explicit.
There's the hero we've been waiting for.
It's actually good to have you here.
You want to know something else? That's pretty funny. When Andre shows up at the castle, what has he got? What is he getting people's attention with at the door? The big giant door knockers. And all I could look at it was say,
"What knockers?"
That's all I could think of as well. I was like, I was waiting for Terry Garr to come by and say,
"Thank you, Doctor."
I'm always waiting for Terry Garr to come by and say why thank you.
Yeah.
And Fredo and Frau Blücher.
I was waiting. Who's going to do it?
You're welcome.
Oh, but, you know, I mean, in damn you, Mel Brooks. You know? Every time they make a Robin Hood movie, they burn our village to the ground. But, we're not a Mel Brooks podcast, although that's an awesome idea. Hero, write that down.
So as a segue, Luke, let me ask you, how does this fit into the entirety of the Italian films, especially, I guess, the Giallo films? Is that how you pronounce them? Would this be considered Giallo?
Giallo.
Giallo. My Italian's poor. I've been there twice and I can't speak a lick of it. How does this fit into the realm of those films?
Well, it's interesting because Black Sunday is not a giallo. It's a supernatural film, clearly. And whereas giallo, and we'll talk about this more next time because the next film we're going to watch is a giallo. Giallo is a name for the type of fiction that was kind of the Italian equivalent of the pulp fictions that we got here in the United States in the Depression and the pre-war period, where they were called giallos because giallo is the Italian word for yellow, and they were printed on extremely cheap yellow paper that would fall apart as you were reading it. And they dealt with, you know, real crime and maniacs and murders and mysteries and things like that. So while what Bava did here, the major influence that it would have on the Italian horror cinema was the way it was shot more than anything else. All of your successful, well-known Italian horror directors and, you know, folks like Dario Argento, Lucio Fulci, Michele Soavi, Bava's own son, Lamberto Bava. There's a few guys who did some smaller films like Aldo Lado and a few others. They were all either contemporaries with Bava and thus, you know, working from the same sort of cultural zeitgeist that created, you know, his style. Or they worked under him. In the case of Soavi or his son, they were both his assistant directors before they went on to direct their own features. Fulci and Bava were old friends. They had both grew up working in the film industry, and they were friends and had kind of similar ideas about cinema. And Argento credited Mario Bava as his mentor, who got him into working in film. I think some of Argento's earliest film work was as like PA or something for Bava. So Bava creating this strong visual style is what would eventually become the major driving force behind the visual aspect. And milieu, Chris, you referred to this. You called it the Italian vibe, which is a really bad De Manza Corps porno. but it's true. There is a certain milieu along all of these Italian horror films, whether they were, gore fests, like a Diodato type of modernist bloodbath, or if they were a more suspenseful supernatural films. And it runs the gamut. I think all of it was it grew out of this really artfully shot and artfully done cinematography, and that was the major influence, I think, of Black Sunday, because we wouldn't get too many more Italian Gothic horror films. This would shift more to Western Europe. Hammer would play this all the way through the 70s, before they finally closed their doors, and Amicus would do this, and there's a few other smaller studios. But the way that they're shot is a very typical British light and get away type technique. Whereas this was more, it really influenced like the mobile frame, the use of zooming and slam zoom and rack focus and a lot of the yes. techniques you read about in film class, but you don't see a lot of necessarily in American and Western European cinema. You saw it more here. And I think that type of willingness to play with the frame and do something visually arresting, rather than necessarily, in some cases, make a whole lot of sense. I think that was the real this would eventually lead to.
This movie doesn't make a whole lot of... It does make sense in its own sort of world, and it makes sense that it's based on a fable or a myth, more like that. It works almost more on the subconscious than anything else. But it just... It gets you there, and it gets you in that mood. And when you're in that when you're in that place, it just sort of works. It follows a different logic than reality.
Yeah,
the Italians are very, very good at that.
Yeah, I mean there is the film I referred to earlier, Inferno. I defy anyone to figure out what actually is going on in Inferno. there is a loose story that connects the different sequences, but Inferno was designed. But specifically by Argento, to be a cinematic nightmare, insofar as when you're having a nightmare, things can happen without reason and may not be connected to what had happened previously or what happens next, but it's something that happens that is unsettling. And it shoots for mood. In Black Sunday, the narrative is not so important. The narrative is there to get things where they need to be. This is a film about mood and emotive response. Horror is one of the most horror and comedy. I think I've said this before on the show, are the two genres of film that are hardest really to categorize. You can take a Western, and now a Western is a genre film that is defined by its generic elements. There's the Old West, there's horses, there's cowboys, Indians, tumbleweed, shootouts. Okay, this is the things that define a Western. Now inside a Western, you can tell different types of stories, but they're all considered a Western. How do you define a horror film? A horror film is defined by cinematic intent. A horror film is a film that is scary, or tries to be scary in any case. Same with a comedy. A comedy is a film that tries to make you laugh. Inside a horror film or a comedy, we can have any of an infinite number of cinematic elements. At the end of the day, it's intent. So what is the intent in Black Sunday? Is the intent to scare you with a really involved story that gets you on the edge of your seat? No, the intent is to scare you by creating a mood that is so dreadful and so claustrophobic and is shot in such a way that you're not taking your eyes off of it, that this is what creates the mood. This is what creates the, gothic feelings of that you're getting as you're watching the film.
Well, and with all the elements of the story, you sort of pretty much know how it's going to go. You can sort of pretty much see how all those elements, play out. And I mean, there's a little suspense because at the end, the heroine may or may not live or what that, but you sort of know what it has to go through. So it's more about going through that process than, the suspense of wondering if everybody's going to make it through alive.
And part of that is that horror as a genre is so ripe with cliches that we kind of come to love them. You don't watch a slasher film because, oh, I wonder who's gonna make it. No, you watch a slasher because you know that 95% of the cast who has names is gonna die. You're watching it to see how they die. You know
how and when.
Yeah. So, but he goes, "That was so awesome, bro." You know, that's what I do. I don't know about the rest of you folks.
Yeah, that's exactly what I do too.
Or you go, "Oh, ow."
I actually, a guy I went to school with, his brother was kicked out of a screening of Friday the 13th Part 8, Jason Takes Manhattan, because he refused to stop laughing after Jason punched the guy's head off. So.
What? He was enjoying the movie like he was. Yes, exactly. He was enjoying the movie the way it was meant to be enjoyed.
Apparently he was disruptive. I don't know.
Oh, no. That audience didn't deserve to see that movie.
No.
Which is really funny when you start saying that about, like, Friday the 13th, Part 8.
Part 8, yeah.
I think most of the audience didn't deserve to see that movie.
They were not worthy of that movie. That's a piece of shit audience right there, man. Jeez.
Yeah.
So,
Be gone!
Yeah.
Be gone.
Be gone with you! Little boss man.
Do you not understand this art?
Jason
is not just taking Manhattan, don't you see?
He is Manhattan. Don't be fools around ourselves, you know. You know,
did you guys watch a different film than I did? Because that film was awful. I would rather watch Jason X with the guy spiraling down the giant corkscrew than Jason X.
Jason X.
I will brook no criticism of Jason X. I saw that in the theater with my buddy Larry, and we had a ball watching it.
My favorite one of those is number 6, and that's the one with the most intentional setups for gags in the whole series.
True. Yeah, but that also has 2 songs by Alice Cooper, so...
True.
You can't...
Also a bonus.
But that's not Black Sunday.
That's not Black... and nor is it Black Friday, which is a song by Megadeth, which I keep coming back to.
And a movie with a blimp.
And a movie with a blimp, yes. What's funny is that Leonard Maltin actually rates the blimp version of Black Sunday higher than this one. And I like the blimp version of Black Sunday, but come on, Maltin. Really?
Is that the one where it's all fat actors?
Yes, that's the blimp movie.
I think it is, yeah.
It's like the beginning of Back to School. I need some fat actors, No, but and you know, it's funny because if you read the Leonard Maltin guide, he gives the film 2.5 stars, which at first always makes me stop because he gave Laser Blast 2.5 stars.
I don't like Leonard Maltin. I'm sorry. I've never liked Leonard Maltin. I think he's a dork.
And I don't like Maltin either. But you want to know what Leonard Maltin's book is really good for? And I am saying this without hyperbole and without sarcasm. His book is fantastic for getting running times of films.
Uh-huh.
You need an accurate running time. His book has it.
Oh, I have his I have his books. And the thing is, there can be critics that I hate, but that still doesn't mean that reading their critiques doesn't help me with that movie, because I can take them with a grain of salt, you know, but I can sort of see what elements I'm looking for. And it's always interesting to hear what he has to say, but I don't think I'd get along with him in person.
Well, in this case, you can tell that whether it was him or one of his, because this is the big, like, you know, 5-inch thick movie guide book.
Right.
And growing up, my dad always had one of these sitting next to the television, so now I have also inherited that habit. And again, it's great for running times, you know, or, oh, what year was that made, you know, or something like that, without having to run to the computer. But you can tell this is one of the ones that either he or one of his associates didn't actually watch because they get the plot wrong.
Ooh.
So, and that's always embarrassing, you know. It's like when Roger Ebert said that Star Trek Generations opened with Kirk and Picard on the bridge of the Enterprise. And it's like, did you watch the film, Rog? The session stand pumped directly into your veins.
Oh, Jesus.
Animaniacs joke. Thank you. Thank you.
Hey, this was also the first movie that we've done that had a warning at the beginning of it, I noticed. I was like, it's about time that we have a movie that's predicated with, you know, you should have a strong and healthy heart and no nervous conditions and stuff like that.
Those who are pregnant or may become pregnant should not see this film.
But, you know, it's a lot of the stuff as far as you will actually see that a couple more times, and that a lot of it had to do with there's no rating system in Italy, and at least there wasn't when a lot of these films are being made. So, like the classic one that was on Dawn of the Dead, because Dawn of the Dead was released unrated, the one that said there is no graphic sex in this film, however, it does depict violence of a gruesome nature or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
That kind of warnings were common in European cinema, just because, except for like the British Video Nasty Board, there was no real classification system. They just kind of put movies out, and if kids saw them, oh well, you know.
Plus, it's also great publicity.
Oh yeah. We'll see that, especially when we get to Fulci. Fulci used that to. Oh, he never let something like that go to waste. No. And Bava and Fulci also very similar in that they both were just kind of kindly looking old grandfatherly types that produced these horrific, scary movies, you know.
Oh, wonderful.
Yes. So anyone else have any other closing thoughts you want to talk about here with Black Sunday from anyone?
This is a great beginning to the idea of Italian horror. And from what I'm getting, it's definitely more mood-based than gore-based. Setting up a mood that's going to unnerve you or frighten you. And I'm hoping that's what we're going to get within some of the other horror films.
We're in the waiting. It's like the wading pool. It's like nice warm water, you know, before we get shoved into the deep end with, you know, like zombie or something like that.
But I had another analogy in mind. This is just the tip, just for a minute, just to see how it feels. But
that's definitely a more Italian way to describe it. Yes,
and what we'll see is that while, you know, mood will continue to be important, but the visual aspects and the gruesome aspects will be there as well. But we'll still see that, like, okay, well, yeah, this is a shockingly gory film, but this other part of it that's all suspense is what's scary, you know?
Yeah.
So you'll definitely see both sides of the coin, of the lira, if you will. Although the lira never had coin. You know, when they introduced the euro, one of the countries that had the least valued currency when the euro was introduced was Italy. So they were one of the ones to jump onto the euro because the lira was so worthless. Did you know that for about 6 months, there was this booming market in Italy for new wallets because none of the wallets they sold had coin areas in them.
Oh.
There were no lira coins that anyone held. They were worth fractions of cents. So nobody carried any coins for lira. But just want to put out there that Black Sunday is available on DVD. It was released by Image Entertainment in back in 99. That is currently out of print, but you can find it. Same with the Anchor Bay one, which I know was included in the Mario Bava collection box. I think they also sold Black Sunday as a single DVD. I know that some of them were exclusive. I want to say Knives of the Avengers was exclusive to the box set, but that one wasn't. And shortly after we're recording this, on September 18th, Kino Lorber is going to be releasing the film on Blu-ray. Which should be really, really.
That should be gorgeous.
That should be real. And it does have an audio commentary from Tim Lucas, who's a noted Bava historian who wrote a couple of books on Mario Bava. So that should be worth picking up if you haven't seen it. Or, you know, just rent it from Netflix and give it a shot. I think if you've never watched a European horror film, specifically an Italian one, you cannot go wrong starting with Black Sunday. And I think it'll be an enjoyable evening of being a little freaked out in your living room.
Yeah. Definitely.
Yeah.
Sounds like most of my dates.
Oh!
And that's our cue to exit.
Fortunately, it's not, because we do got to mention what we're going to be watching next time.
Right.
Damn it.
Oh, that's true.
Premature as usual.
It's like It's like my buddy Bob always says, you know, men don't suffer from premature ejaculation. Women suffer.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Speaking of women suffering, our next film is from 1963 and is titled The Girl Who Knew Too Much. And The Girl Who Knew Too Much is considered by many filmmakers to be Bava's single masterpiece film. It is also generally considered to be the first giallo. So we're going to be jumping into that pool very shortly. And so Girl Knew Too Much, again, is available on DVD. I'm sure you could find it on Netflix if you needed to. It might even be on like Amazon Prime. Hey, if you watch these films and like them, be sure to go to the Amazon.com link on 2TrueFreaks.Libsyn.com, click through and buy it. Because that'll keep the lights on here at the vault, the mood lighting that we have here as we're recording in the studio, and keep more of these shows coming, so you can sound smart at parties when you talk about your Italian horror films with your friends.
Yes.
Yeah. The trick to sounding smart when talking about horror at a Halloween party is to say a lot of names that end in vowels, and that's also going to guarantee that you look like you know what you're talking about, and the other person probably hasn't seen the film. So everyone, please come on back next time. We'll be looking at The Girl Who Knew Too Much. And I want to say thank you to everyone for listening. Hope you enjoyed the show. So good night, everybody.
Bye.
See you.
Or say ciao.
Ciao.
Arrivederci.
Ciao.
Do not take CIO if you may be pregnant or become pregnant.
CIO may result in anal leakage.
Do you ever find yourself going to Amazon.com and buying some record or movie or some stupid thing that Two True Freaks have been talking about so that you can catch up on it or you've been reminded of it or something? Well, now, how about this? Instead of going to Amazon.com, go to 2TrueFreaks.Libsyn.com and follow our link to Amazon.com. When you do that, if you buy something over at Amazon, we get a little cut out of it, which is awesome because we love money and it won't cost you a thing.
You can sponsor an episode of this or any other of your favorite Two True Freaks affiliated shows. Simply click the PayPal link on our website, donate any amount at all, tell us which show you're choosing and what message, if any, you'd like us to read on your behalf, and you will be an official sponsor of that show's very next episode, with your message read in the show's opener. It's that easy, and there is no minimum donation. Be a show sponsor today. Visit our website at twotruefreaks.libsyn.com. Two True Freaks is always spelled TWOTRUEFREAKS. Libsyn is spelled LIBSYN.
You can email Two True Freaks directly at twotruefreaks@gmail.com.
Join our forum at forumforgeeks.com, where you can discuss all of the shows on our feed with us and your fellow listeners.
You can find Two True Freaks on Facebook. Just search for Two True Freaks.
And hey, you can friend me, Scott Gardner, on Facebook too. My name is spelled ScottGardner.
You can friend me on Facebook too, if you can find me.
Now available, Two True Freaks t-shirts. See our website for details.
Two True Freaks is a very proud member of the Comics Podcast Network. You can check that out at www.comicspodcast.com, where you can hear our new episodes when we put them up.
We are also members of the League of Comic Book Podcasts. For more information, visit comicbooknoise.com/league.
If you ever leave your house and you actually have friends, why don't you tell them about Two True Freaks? Thanks for listening.
And join us every Monday for new episodes of
Two True Freaks.
We're off? Good. Well, that ought to hold the little bastards.